This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And this week on NPR, we've been looking at the widening political divide between generations. Today, one group that's divided among itself, Generation X. They've grown up now. They're in their 30s and 40s, starting to feel the pressures of family life, caring for children, starting to worry about retirement. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, Generation X is hard to peg, politically or otherwise.
When older Gen Xers came of age, it was morning in America. President Reagan was wildly popular. The smartest college grads headed to Wall Street, which gave rise to a generational icon in Gordon Gekko.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
Just a few years later, younger Gen Xers identified with the saxophone-playing President Clinton. They were dubbed the MTV generation, defined by slackers and grunge, like Nirvana's anthem to apathy.
They are a generation that was brought up in the boom days to some extent.
Michael Dimmock is with the Pew Research Center.
Their early adulthood was the 1990s, and those were great times. And now this economy has turned around on them, and many of them are feeling more pinched than any other generation.
A new Pew survey on generational politics finds a big spike in Gen Xers' concern about their personal financial situation. Dimmock says for many, the impact of the recession seems to be cumulative.
When we interviewed Xers 2 years ago, they weren't thinking about retirement. They had other problems. But now they're becoming increasingly worried about having enough money to get through their retirement.
And that's true for people like Dan Sullivan, just 36 years old, with decades of employment ahead of him.
I don't see myself retiring. I don't think it's possible.
Sullivan's pushing his 3-month-old son in a stroller in downtown Frederick, Maryland, a colonial-era town of red brick storefronts. He's an active-duty soldier, so says he's been sheltered from a lot of the economic turmoil. But like a third of Xers, he's lost faith in the social programs set up to cushion old age.
I don't think Social Security is going to be there for us. And Medicare, I don't think that's going to be there. And even if so, I mean, at this point, I kind of don't want the government's Medicare. I mean, really, I think you have to plan to be totally independent at this point.
Although Sullivan admits that doesn't actually seem possible either. Sullivan's a lifelong conservative, but he's not thrilled with any of the GOP presidential candidates. In a hypothetical matchup between President Obama and Mitt Romney,
I'd probably lean a little bit more towards Romney, but I don't think he's all that great either.
A block away, 33-year-old Leah Furman Fell sits with her dog outside the Starbucks, where she's a barista.
Obviously, I'm not making any money right now for retirement.
Though she's making plans to get back into her former field of internet marketing, and Furman Fell's fiancé is a gainfully employed architect. Still, like many Gen Xers, they had the misfortune to buy their house at the height of the market.
Oh, we're screwed. The house next door to us went into foreclosure for less than half what we paid, so we'll never leave.
Furman Fell is a lifelong liberal, though like many Gen Xers, says she's open to persuasion. As a group, Gen X leaned Democratic in 2008, then Republican in the 2010 midterms. Furman Fell says she likes some Republican politicians, but none are moderate enough to get her vote.
But I still really like, you know, Barack Obama. I think that he's been too nice, but I think if he comes in for a second term, he'll do what he wants to do, and I hope that's what he does.
Today, the Pew survey finds a majority of Generation X has an unfavorable view of the Republican Party, and most are disappointed with President Obama. They're not as down on him as older voters, but then researcher Michael Dimmock says the older generation never got on the Obama bandwagon to start with.
I think the Xers and Boomers, in some respects, have moved farther on Obama, going from being supporters of him to being at least on the fence, if not somewhat unhappy with what he's done.
Pew finds an even split in Gen X support for President Obama and Mitt Romney. Those on either side, though, say they're waiting to be impressed. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Now, for the occupiers, it may be all about the Benjamins. But what happens when you use real money to buy imaginary things? It's happening every day on Facebook. People are paying to buy things for pretend farms and cities, thanks to Zynga, a virtual goods company. This industry took in $9 billion real dollars last year alone from consumers buying tractors and buildings that don't exist. Now Zynga is going public with an IPO expected in the next few weeks, and Zynga is trying hard to get ahead of the game by dropping millions of dollars on a few new games, including Castleville. NPR's Arthi Shahani set off to understand the market value of a business built on nothing.
We'll start with the tour of Piskorskyville. It's a bustling city full of stores, row houses, and red brick condos. A policeman patrols downtown, waving his baton. Northeast, there's a small community garden.
I forgot to come back to my city, so some of my plans have withered away, and my friends actually have been kind enough to come back and unwither some of my plans.
That's Meshek Piskorsky, the city's namesake. But city is a slight misnomer. Piskorskyville doesn't really exist. Or one could say it totally does, on his computer screen. Meshek is sitting in his office at Harvard Business School. He's a professor. His job? To play and study popular online games like Cityville by Zynga. Meshek harvests his virtual crop and sells to a local grocer. Not for cash, at least not the green folding type. His money, like his goods, are virtual. But for 5% of Zynga's 200 million monthly users, that's not the case.
You can buy a special currency, and you can use it in two ways. You can spend it on speeding up certain processes or getting some functionalities that are available to you that are not available to others. But you can also spend the currency on beautifying the city.
Luxury condos, yachts, they won't have a use.
But they will be just really beautiful to look at.
Zynga raked in $1 billion in sales this last year. That's $1 billion U.S. dollars, the green folding type. In sales of virtual tractors that plow virtual farms, or avatars that make gamers just a bit more beautiful to look at. 19-year-old Tiara Kate sells Zynga currency at a CVS in Washington, D.C. She points to a shelf lined with prepaid cards, Starbucks, Lowe's Theater, and one with a goofy duck waddling up a pasture. That's for Farmville, Zynga's mega hit.
I've seen kids come in with their parents and cry for these cards, or older people, like between late 30, early 40, a lot of them buy the Farmville cards.
Why are you laughing? Why is it funny?
Because my dad does it too, and I think it's like ridiculous. I think it's, say it's a $20 gift card. When it's gone, you'll be buying another one.
That's exactly the point. Traditional video games make you pay up front. Zynga inverted the model. Play for free, and once you're hooked, pay to get ahead. Zynga officials declined an interview because, they said, they're in a quiet period required by the Securities and Exchange Commission before the IPO. Eric Ries, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Lean Startup, is a Zynga fan. Or, to be more precise, a critic of the critics. To those who say virtual goods aren't real,
I don't think that you're using the word real correctly. What is real?
Fashionistas spend $2,000 on a Prada handbag. Gamers spend $20 on an imaginary tractor or avatar or sword. Same difference. Except,
unlike in the physical world, the virtual objects are all tied to the specific environment in which they were developed. So if you have a sword in a game like World of Warcraft, you can't take that sword with you into the real world, but you also can't take it with you into other games.
The Zynga IPO is a test of whether this new thing, the virtual good, is durable.
Maybe just it's a fad.
That's Sam Hamada, CEO of Privco. He sifts through the financial data of private corporations. He estimates Zynga is worth $5 billion. Others say $20 billion. Ironically, it comes down to whether competitors buy into the business model.
Now that they've shown the way, the question is, will traditional gaming companies like Electronic Arts, like Activision, you know, will Disney then start offering games based on its characters in the same model?
Zynga broke the curse of online businesses. It kicked the addiction to ad revenue, the bane of the web. The ads it does have enhanced the game. American Express sponsors blue virtual windmills that help grow crops. Lady Gaga sexed up the scene by releasing her album Born This Way on Gagaville. Zynga's IPO will now test whether the company's modern-day alchemy, turning virtual goods into real money, is a game-changer for the gaming industry. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz, and we begin this hour with a number.
80,000. That's how many jobs the U.S. economy added last month, according to the Labor Department. And the unemployment rate fell slightly as well to 9%. Now, while any job growth is a positive sign, NPR's Chris Arnold reports that today's number was less than most economists had hoped for. It's also not nearly enough to keep up with the number of people in need of work.
The economy averaged 114,000 new jobs a month since August, which might sound like a good thing, but there are about 14 million Americans unemployed and looking for work. Add to that population growth, and by one estimate, at this rate it would take 30 years to bring down unemployment to pre-recession levels. And speaking from the G20 summit in France, President Obama said today that this is why Congress should pass his jobs bill.
My hope is that the folks back home, including those in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, when they look at today's job numbers, which were positive, but indicate once again that the economy is growing way too slow, that they think twice before they vote no again.
Still, there's been some progress. The number of people unemployed for more than 6 months fell pretty sharply, down by about 500,000 people. But that still leaves more than 5 million people who've been out of work longer than 6 months, and some of them much longer.
I was laid off in December of 2008 from Citibank.
Mark Hoffman is 49 years old and still out of work. He used to be in charge of some back office computer systems at the bank, and he made around $100,000 a year. We found him yesterday at the Occupy Boston protest. And his struggle over the past few years mirrors what's happened with a lot of Americans.
I've gone through my unemployment. I eventually ended up wiping out my 401k.
Hoffman says after a year or so, he just kind of gave up.
Hopelessness is a good description. It reaches a point where you just, you know, there is no way out.
So what Hoffman eventually did was change careers, or at least he's trying to. He's going back to school to become, of all things, a locksmith.
Locksmithing, it's a nice puzzle. I went into technology because I like puzzles and problems. Locksmithing is puzzles and problems.
And Hoffman says you can't outsource it.
There's also a lot of new technology in locksmithing. A lot of access control is card-based.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, yeah, so you could do a physical lock installation, but then also do a security swipe card.
Right.
Hoffman probably won't make as much money as he used to, but what he's doing likely makes a lot of sense. John Sylvia is the chief economist at Wells Fargo.
Many people are coming to the realization that the old job and the old location are not going to suffice, and they have to change jobs or change careers and or change location.
You can see this with retail workers. The country has lost hundreds of thousands of retail jobs since the recession hit. And with more automated checkout kiosks at grocery stores and pharmacies, and then there's all the online shopping, many of those jobs just may not be coming back. So some people who used to work in retail need to find other kinds of work. And that leads to what economists refer to as structural unemployment, people without the right skills to get new jobs or who just live in the wrong place.
Chairman Bernanke's question and answer period earlier this week, how much of this 9% unemployment is structural? From our point of view, probably 2 to 2.5% of this is structural.
Meaning that the unemployment rate would be a lot lower if job seekers had the right skills. This is why so many economists are saying that retraining and education are especially important in this economic recovery. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. 19 days. That's how long the Congressional Supercommittee has to make a deal to reduce the nation's deficit by at least $1.2 trillion. So far, taxes have been the sticking point, or as they seem to be known here in Washington these days, revenues. Republicans have resisted, but Democrats insist that new taxes must be part of any deal. Well, there are signs now of a possible breakthrough. Speaker of the House John Boehner suggested yesterday that there is room for revenue as long as any increases are paired with cuts to entitlement programs. And 40 Republican House members signed a letter addressed to the Supercommittee Wednesday saying that all options for spending and revenues must be on the table. Among those Republicans was Charles Bass of New Hampshire. He joins us now from his office. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Talk to me about what kind of taxes or revenue increase you would be willing to support as part of a deficit reduction deal.
Well, I think the other signers of this letter are trying to avoid making specific recommendations to the committee. But what we really want them to do is to feel that they can address the issue of revenues, be it through closing loopholes, making the tax code simpler, working with the Democrats to come up with a proposal. And what we're trying to say on the one hand is don't be restricted by the dogma of either party, while on the other hand, understand that you have to come up with a plan that is big and not little. We believe that $1.5 trillion worth of reductions in the growth of government does not satisfy the mandate of our group, because we believe that the American people expect more from the Congress.
So, Congressman Bass, in simple language, what you're saying is Democrats have to be willing to make painful cuts and Republicans have to be willing to consider the possibility of an increase in taxes.
Exactly right.
You have signed a Grover Norquist's pledge not to raise taxes, as have most of your colleagues. Is that a problem? For you and for your other colleagues?
I'm prepared to make big decisions that may be politically difficult. The Grover Norquist tax pledge, which I signed, I believe in. I don't believe we should be raising taxes, but I also don't believe that deficits and the debt can continue on its current course. So I have to make a choice if the committee comes up with a big deal, if you will, that includes revenue increases that may be in conflict with the Grover Norquist tax pledge. I would only point out that at the beginning of this year, I took a pledge to uphold the Constitution of the United States and defend America against enemies, both domestic and foreign. And I consider the debt crisis in this country to be a real threat to the future of America.
Do you believe many of your fellow Republicans would say the same thing?
Yes, I do. I think in the end, especially if the American people say, please save this country for future generations. I say to my colleagues in jest, how can you not be for a big plan when the American people hold us in such disrespect now? I mean, how can it be any worse?
If it fails, as you know, there are automatic triggers that would require drastic cuts, at least a third of the Pentagon's budget, for example. If it doesn't succeed, are we talking about some very, very big problems ahead?
Well, I think that the specter of across-the-board sequestration, which is what you just described, is very ugly. And that is one of the persuaders, if you will, that members need to be willing to work together and compromise. I, for one, will not vote to waive the sequestration process because I really think that we need to apply maximum pressure on all lawmakers to take difficult positions that require courage to resolve this nation's crisis, just as is going on in other countries around the world.
Even if it means you will lose your seat for voting for it.
I got elected to Congress last year, from my perspective, to solve this nation's problems. I'm not here to win elections.
Congressman Bass, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Charlie Bass is a Republican congressman from New Hampshire.